Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Carlton Gibson, and I'm joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
And today we have Anna Keither with us. And Anna, we're going to talk about GeoDjango. So how are you, Anna?
I'm doing well. How are you, Beth?
I think we're marvellous, but thank you for coming on the show. So
yeah, happy to be here.
Well, awesome. Let's kick off. Perhaps a good way of getting, if you could introduce yourself, tell us about your background, how you got into program, for instance,
yeah.
Or on how you discovered Django and such things like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I got into software development through a bit of a roundabout way. I'm not sort of formally, you know, trained as a computer software engineer, but I was working at World Wildlife Fund on their renewable energy team. And was tasked with helping sort of design and build, you know, a simple just website for some of our corporate renewable energy partners. And that's where I got introduced to software development.
Okay.
And I really loved that. And so I did a fellowship in San Francisco. You know, that gave me a little bit more, of course, more foundational knowledge. And I wanted to combine energy, my sort of interest in energy and the power grid with programming and software engineering.
Okay.
So building web applications, you know, sort of track and measure the energy grid and I guess the physical world around us.
Yeah.
I started as a software engineer at Kavala Analytics, and they're an energy analytics startup in San Francisco. And they do a lot of mapping. So, you know, mapping feeder or distribution lines, substations, transformers, solar panels. So mapping all and aggregating all this energy data. And that's where I started learning Django and using GeoDjango.
Okay. And so what were you using before, just out of interest?
I don't think we weren't really utilizing any, I think just Postgres, right? And so doing raw sort of, you know, using PG2 or something and connecting to Postgres that way and not really, you know, very hacky, I guess, not really using an interface.
But you were lucky enough to start with Python then?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. When I came on board onto Kavala, they were using already using Python and already using Django. I don't think they had started utilizing GeoDjango.
Okay, so tell us about GeoDjango. What is GeoDjango?
Yeah, so GeoDjango is Django's sort of answer to geospatial mapping. So it's their geospatial web framework. It's just a contrib module, basically, through Django that handles geographic information. It offers, you know, the ability, like Django, to, you know, have models and classes. But in addition, it offers the ability to handle, manipulate geospatial data, transform it.
When you say handle geographical data, what sort of things am I going to do with it? What sort of uses am I going to have?
Right. Yeah. So I think maybe the easiest way to describe this, maybe let's take type of data might want to model, right? So say a road.
Okay.
And so just like a regular Django class or model, you might have, you know, a road has a name, a road has maybe a length, a road has maybe the state that it's in, all of this sort of, you know, metadata that are just strings. But a road also has a geometry associated with it. And so GeoDjango allows you to specify a geometry field. And this can be a point, a line, a polygon, you know, a multi-line, a multi-polygon. I think there's like 8 different types, something like that. And you basically specify this. So a road, you know, road would probably best fit as a line. Through that attribute, you're able to do transforms, you're able to do other sort of geospatial and distance queries. Yeah.
So could I create a TomTom type app? Like a you know, if I had all the roads in this line.
You're dating yourself with that reference.
I probably am. What's a TomTom?
Google Maps?
Could I do Google Maps? Like turn by turn direction, I guess is the
right
thing.
Could I
do something like that?
We did not build something at all like that. Well, you know, we had a map and we had, but yeah, that and some other fancy, you know, algorithms and optimizations, you could in effect create Google Maps where you enter in, you know, the address of your destination and it geolocates your specific point. And using GeoDjango, you could route to that point, the fastest way or something.
But Google Maps is quite pretty, right? It's got those nice tiles and it shows me the pictures. But how would I do that with GeoDjango?
Right.
Can I use Google Maps with it, or do I?
Yeah, you could use Google Maps API, certainly, with using GeoDjango as the framework, backend framework. So what the user sees on the front end, right, is just, you know, the Google Map, those are like Google Maps tiles. Of course, Google Maps also uses like all the API layer and all the fancy things. But you could certainly use, you know, say Leaflet or Mapbox with like different actual tiles that are, say, the Google Maps tiles. And that is just what you're seeing, what you're viewing.
It's like the skin on top of the...
Right, on top.
So
I was just going to say, so I've used Leaflet and Mapbox, and I was curious for you, Anna, how would you describe the options available? Because, I mean, Leaflet is open source. Mapbox is open source data, though they're VC funded, and then Google is their own thing. I think because Google, I'm dating myself, 5-6 years ago, Google did one of their periodic, we should monetize our API things for Google Maps, and charge like hellacious rates, and then everyone got all excited about kind of Mapbox and these open source. So what's your take of the landscape, right? Because I know now there's Apple Maps.
I
guess the interesting divide
map
is
a different, is another.
Uses that data, right? Mm. I think, or used to. They were a skin on top of. So I guess the two parts are there's like proprietary data, which like Google and Apple don't share. And then there is OpenStreetMap, which I believe is what powers Mapbox and Leaflet.
Yeah.
And Leaflet is more of a open source, whereas Mapbox is also open source, but has raised a ton of money. And
Right. I think that ultimately Mapbox is the umbrella over Leaflet, and Leaflet's the Mapbox sort of free.
Oh yeah,
lower.
That's right. They hired the Leaflet guy, as I recall. But anyway, so how do you think about this with projects, right? Because at least I simply break it down into like, yeah, there's Google APIs, but they could charge a lot, and there's open source. What are the factors you think about, like for a personal project, like because you have some really cool ones on your site, which we'll link to, versus an enterprise setting? Are there any distinctions there that you would make?
Right. I would say ease, you know, ease of use, and that's where Leaflet and Mapbox to me have really made it. Like their documentation is really great.
Yeah, they're way better.
Yeah, I mean, we were actually at Kavala, we were using OpenStreetMap and not using Leaflet or Mapbox, and we found it a little bit. They're a team of I think they're volunteer. So it wasn't just
anyone can
full...
do it. Like you and I could go in, and it's sort of like Wikipedia,
right? Which in some regards is really great. But I guess they were less full featured than we wanted. Leaflet just has so many sort of bells and whistles. If you want to create a map that looks really nice, it's got the ability to do choropleths, which are just overlays. It's got, a really easy way to code, satellite toggle, pop-ups, all these sort of the things that, a user would expect to see on a map.
You say a little more about choropleths? Because if people haven't used like Leaflet mapping, that's a big word. How would you explain that further? I've used it, but it tripped me up at first.
Right. Yeah.
Or what's an example, right? Like, I mean, example would be something like, I don't know, a color scheme for
a density.
Like you have,
say,
right? You've, you have predicting disease spread as one of your projects,
right?
Like,
right.
Where it's redder, right? That would be an example of a clear
exactly.
Plan.
Yeah. So it's a you know way to visually you know display data when say points or lines don't convey the information you want. So something that's like disease spread would be really, you know, a good way of sort of maybe, or where you would use a choropleth. That way, you know, areas that are really affected by the disease are really dark or dense, and areas that are not.
So it's like a temperature map on a weather forecast,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Same I was just thinking like, or like a political, like a red, blue, purple, like US political kind of map.
Okay. Yeah. And all of this is built into Leaflet, and that's
that
Leaflet.js. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And is that part of GeoDjango, or do you have to pull that in for your front end when you're writing your templates?
Right. So that's not part of GeoDjango exactly. When you basically after you construct your view, you throw the sort of Leaflet. You use the Leaflet API to just pull a map up in the browser. And display your tiles, and then you send your GeoJSON, oftentimes from Django, to display on the front end.
Okay, and how do I serialize? So say I've created a Django model, a GeoDjango model, and I've got some geographic data in there. I've got my roads or the shops in my town where I want to go shopping next week. I've put that into GeoDjango for some reason. How do I send that to the front end? Do I need to use REST framework, or can I just send? Does GeoDjango give me the serialization tools I need just to send GeoJSON?
That would be the same way you would send data through Django. So you would use views.py. It's been a little while since I've used Django, but so you use your views.py and then your URLs, you use GeoDjango to, once you've retrieved your data from whatever database, to serialize that data as GeoJSON.
The question was that it include GeoDjango gives me the serializers I need to turn right. Okay.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you need to pull in a third party like REST framework or I don't know what.
Right. Right. I believe it gives you the serializers you need. Yep.
Fine. Okay,
and along
super.
With, I think the biggest benefit or the biggest, the biggest benefit, I guess, that I liked using GeoDjango for was that, you didn't need to do these sort of hairy SQL queries, raw queries in your Python. It provides an interface to PostGIS, which is Postgres's, geographic database, to do these, perform these queries, much simpler. And so, a query, say, taking that roads example, say you want to find, all of the roads that intersect with a hospital, or that, run into a hospital or that are within, a certain distance of your hospital, GeoDjango provides a really easy way of filtering and doing these distance queries. Whereas with, just with SQL, it's, a little bit more confusing, I guess.
That's Django ORM to save us from raw.
Yeah.
So you had a fantastic talk on GeoDjango, which we'll link to, which is, I think, how Carlton and I both came to know of you. But can you recall, what was the process of, how would you recommend someone learn GeoDjango? Because it is a somewhat advanced use of Django and these other technologies. How would you baby step someone up that curve if you could do it again? Because I suspect you were kind of maybe thrown in the deep end, or did you start more on the front end JavaScript side before?
I started actually with Flask. As many, I think, Python users do, go from Flask and then think, something with a little bit more, I guess, bells and whistles and structure.
Batteries.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I just remember for the first project I did, I was banging my head against the wall. I did this project where I mapped landfills across the U.S., because I wanted a user to be able to enter their zip code and then see where their trash, you know, routed to. And if that landfill was full, you know, or how close to capacity that landfill was. Anyways, and I remember banging my head against the wall, trying to, you know, figure out, you know, how to get this data to just display on my tiles. And it was probably something very minor that I had done wrong. And, you know, all of a sudden the entire U.S. was full, you know, I must've made one tweak and all the U.S. was full with landfills, you know?
Yeah. I mean, mapping something
that's quite
really
realistic. No?
It's hard. And then you also, you have the visual component. So it's not like just like a little, you know, error. It's just like, you're like, you can see the mistake that you made.
Yeah. 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 And oftentimes, you know, there's simple things like the lat long, you know, switching those.
Yeah, I know you mentioned you had that.
Yeah, yeah. So geographic systems oftentimes, I think nearly all the time, actually, PostGIS, certainly GeoDjango, they use longitude and then latitude to define a point, whereas users are a little bit more familiar with latitude, you know, and then longitude following.
Right, XY makes more sense than YX.
Right, right. Anyways, yeah, so how would I get started with GeoDjango? So GeoDjango does have this great tutorial on, you know, seeding a database with some GeoJSON or with a shapefile. And then it walks you through, you know, the process of querying that data and manipulating it a little bit. What you could also do is just, if you don't want to worry, you know, don't want to deal with, you know, maybe setting up a database connection, you could just, you know, import GeoDjango and grab some GeoJSON, you know, in a one, you know, in a Python file and, just,
yeah,
you know, use the methods that way. That's really not using all of, you know, the things that GeoDjango offers, but it would allow you to say, you know, very simple sort of queries.
Well, because you could pull in like a GeoJSON of like a map of like the U.S. states, right? Or just to like sort of explain how. So GeoJSON, excuse me.
Right.
But I mean, like if you pulled, so if you had like a discrete data set of GeoJSON, is that kind of like it would have like the outlines of the? Am I getting that right? Like there was.
Yeah. So GeoJSON,
like what would you import, right? Like where would you get it and what would it actually look like before you applied chloropleths to it?
Chloropleths, right.
Plaths? I'm saying it wrong.
Plaths. I think it's chloropleths, but I always forget if there's one L or two.
Yeah.
Like chloro or choro.
It sounds like very scientific.
Right.
Anyways, yeah, that sort of didn't really make any sense. But I guess I was asking... if you think of, so you have your data and then you have how it's displayed and then you have, or how does GeoJSON differ from the skins that we've been talking about, like Leaflet and Mapbox?
Right.
Because a lot of times you need to have the GeoJSON yourself or get it from somewhere
right
before you can apply that skin on top. But it's different from the coordinates that it would be in the database itself with,
right.
In your Django database.
Yeah. So a Leaflet or a Mapbox or some other, you know, sort of front-end web framework like that allows you to display this data. And so the GeoJSON or the shapefile or whatever, you know, that is the actual data that you care about that you're going to put on the map and you're going to use Mapbox or Leaflet to, you know, get it on your map and to display it. So GeoJSON is just one form of geographic data. And this is, you know, GeoDjango and PostGIS allow you to transform, you know, you can turn your GeoJSON into a well-known text or well-known binary. And use it that way as well.
Right. Well, I guess I'm trying to think, so like if you had like a table of GeoDjango data, so rectangular, and then on top of that you could get the GeoJSON or your shape files, and so then it could say if I'm within the shape of a U.S. state, you could map and see does the data point in my database fit into this particular shape, and if so, apply some logic to it. I'm just trying to like verbally think about how all the pieces stack together for people who've never used this before, because it is a little confusing.
So you would have, you know, your...
Like, what's the bottom?
So the bottom would be just the data, right?
Like coordinate data with whatever
coordinate data,
company
exactly.
information. So like at lat long, like disease is 19 out of a scale of 100 or something.
Would be, just your data. And then, you know, you would put that data, you know, into a data table. And again, you would assign a, you know, geometry field to this data.
How would you do that?
That's just done in Django classes.
Oh, right. But that's the one, there's a couple options, right, for how you would do that?
Right.
Because that's like a model class. So like you've got your normal Django model, like your disease rate, and then you want to say it's at this particular location. Is that, so you could add a point field, would that be?
Yeah. So say you have, you know, let's say illness, instances of illness or something, right? You know, you could have, you could have one instance of illness would be a row in your table, and then you would define, you know, as, you know, a column that's that lat long at that location. Right. And that would just be, that would just be a Django point field. And then you'd be able to, you know, take a polygon, say, from a different table. Maybe you have your states table, your U.S. states.
Or towns, or, yeah.
And, you know, do a query to combine these two. So you could say, how many instances of illness are within this particular state?
Okay. And then you'd show it on the map.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is where, GeoDjango is, makes this all very easy and fast.
Super. Okay, and a couple of times you've said PostGIS, which is Postgres, which is like the Postgres extension that enables all this geographic stuff, right?
Yeah. So GeoDjango can be set up, I think, with a number of different databases. MySQL, SQLite.
Spatialite is like the SQLite version.
Yeah.
So that's just a file that, and one might think that's the simplest to get started with, but is that the case? Is it simplest to get started with that, or simplest with Postgres? Or,
I guess so, in the sense that you don't need to. I think that's what Django comes automatically with SQLite.
It
uses it as sort of its default. But it's quite easy to get started with Postgres as well.
Right.
I think it's that you need to add either Spatialite to SQL, which is built into Django, or if you install PostgreSQL, you need to add PostGIS on top of it.
Right.
Yeah, because it's the installation, right? It's the setup. What would you recommend people to do?
Which of the two?
Or the three, you know.
Oracle's not supported, and then MySQL is a bit of a issue, I believe. But you're the expert, so you tell us.
I've actually used primarily Postgres and PostGIS, so I would have to say, you know, use those, but I don't want to make any enemies.
But I've heard tell it's the most capable as well.
What is PostGIS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard people say that it's the more advanced, it's the...
They've done so much with geospatial data. We were, you know, at my current company, we're doing some of these queries by hand using Go, a different, you know, not Python. They get very complex very quickly. So using something like GeoDjango and, you know, and PostGIS really just make these querying and filters so much easier. Leave the hard work to people who have already done it.
Yeah, okay.
Because...
Is the idea...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was... Sorry. I was just going to say various, you know, things that geographic data can be, I wouldn't say finicky, but more like it can be easy to get incorrect, particularly with units, when you're doing filters, you know, is it meters or miles? There's a geography concept, and then there's a geometry concept. And GeoDjango also, reconciles the two of these. But a geometry concept takes the, say, polygon or line, takes the shape, and models it on a 2D plane, whereas a geography uses a spherical representation. So that's sort of, where the state comes in, right? So it's taking, these points and actually models them to coordinates. And this concept, you need to make sure to transition between the two at points, or else, you might be, your units can get all messed up.
And so does GeoDjango do the right thing there? And, if you pass a geometry into a geography, it says, no, hang on, you've got to convert these first.
Yep. And you can specify, typically, I think geometries are more common to use, but you can specify that you want to use a geography. And then it will handle all of that for you. You don't need to, be doing transformations and crazy sort of, X, Y to your projected coordinates, all that.
Right. So,
complication.
Like, the more I listen to you, the more I think, wow, actually, there's just masses being wrapped up here. Masses of maths that you don't have to know, masses of SQL that you don't have to write.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what's the Go equivalent, right? Because I assume at your current job, the idea is that Go is faster in quotes than Python, and therefore you can't use all these nice things. Is there an equivalent framework for Go spatial data?
There are some. I'm trying to think of the one. They're nowhere near as popular as say something like GeoDjango or...
So you have to stifle the urge to say, this was solved if we'd been using what I previously used.
Yeah. In fact, we're switching.
I would.
we're switching back.
Okay.
Are
we're
you
switching
really?
Back, believe it or not. Yeah. And part of the reason is that we were creating all of these, all these functions by hand, basically. I mean, we're using the Go GIS libraries, but even with that, we needed some custom functions that weren't available or aren't available in Go. So actually, yeah, we're switching back to using Python, using PostGIS, which we could have been. We're certainly using with Go as well, but
right. So the database remains the same.
Database
just
remains
use a different
the same.
Framework on top of it.
Yeah, it's more the sort of Python geospatial libraries that are really full featured that we weren't quite getting as much in Go. Again, I don't want to make any enemies and say that there aren't great libraries to use, but...
But it's kind of interesting because, on the chip, Go is faster, it's a faster language, it's more low level, it's got higher throughput, but there's developer time as well. And, if your Python is fast enough, the developer time trumps it, right?
Right.
Well,
right.
I mean, as we talk about often too here, generally in a web stack, the language isn't the big issue. There's a whole lot of other things that are slowing you down.
Yeah. And we found the development with, like I said, the development with Go and with creating these, all these geospatial, functions ourselves to be a lot, it was costly developer time. And we also aren't sure we're doing it right all the time.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Can write your test for your geographic function, but you can make your test pass. It's the beauty of tests. You also write them, so the test pass, but it still may not be entirely accurate. So,
It's sometimes an algorithm matches the test case, but
right.
or the test cases, but
failing.
Then
yeah, they're both errors. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's why you always want to check, does it do what I think and also doesn't do this other thing that it shouldn't do, because sometimes it just always passes.
Right.
So day to day, what does it look like? What are the challenges that you wrestle with? I mean, maybe it sounds like maybe classic data science, where a lot of it is, it's a little bit of algorithms and testing, but a lot of making the data fit and not be wrong, right? Because if it's 0.1% off, it blows everything up. Is that accurate? Or how would you describe... would you describe yourself more in the data science side or more some other area?
Right. Well, I would say, so my previous role, at Kavala, it was a a smaller team than I'm on now, which was awesome because you got to work totally doing everything, you know, from front end, a lot of mapping and core requests to the API layer to, you know, the data ingestion and data pipeline and to our, you know, sort of energy, developing our energy methodologies. And now I am on the data engineering and sort of a little bit more on the data science side of things. And, you know, I'm no longer doing, I guess, the front end mapping, although we certainly have a need for, you know, for a full-fledged front end and map framework, but I'm not currently doing that. So I'm doing more of our data science, productionizing the data science methodologies to do things like create a power network using, you know, machine learning. So figuring out, you know, where feeder systems and feeder lines are on the grid from, you know, from actual data, feeding it into a machine learning model and then validating it and seeing, you know, how close we were using the actual data.
And I assume that's, I mean, that's very Python based most.
Yeah.
Which packages are you using day to day? Which Python ones?
Yeah, you know, right now we're not using a whole lot. And I almost wish we were using something a little bit more. I am spending my time now doing a lot of these raw SQL queries in my Python.
Maybe you get to do an outer join, right? There's a discussion like online. Simon Wilson and some others were saying, you know, like they've never in their career done an outer join.
Oh, even really?
That's asked in every
interview. You know, interview. Right.
But you've never. Gosh. You know, right. In a 20-year career, Simon said maybe once or twice he'd used it.
That's crazy. No, I would, yeah, I do. Well, I mean, I wish it were just an outer join, right? It's like an outer join with, you know, various other, like this, you know, get all the feeder lines within a certain distance, but then mash them to the buildings, you know, and then do a sum of the aggregate on the buildings, you know, so it can get pretty hairy.
Is that something where do people talk about like GraphQL in this context at all? Given that you have, you know, go like non-relational,
right?
Kind of.
Yeah. So before I was on the data team, this data engineering team, I've only been on the team about maybe a month or two. I was in GoLand where it was GraphQL. We were using gRPC and GraphQL.
So postpone the decisions on the relations until later.
Right. Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Sort of. okay. I mean, it seems like, especially the data sets you're dealing with, I mean, it's a sort of, it would make sense to maybe use a non-relational in that context.
Right. Right. And we actually used dGraph, which was a sort of a very, I think it's small. I think it's a team of like five people. And it's a graph database written in Go. So we were using that and it's very fast. But again, it didn't have its syntax is, you know, I guess we're also used to SQL and the SQL syntax. And this really kind of turns that on its head. And so we were spending a lot of developer time just trying to get this syntax working to query the database. I think with, you know, obviously with practice and more experience and as the dGraph team, you know, that software becomes a little bit more mainstream, we might go back to using it. But for now, you know, given all of the geospatial data that we do deal with, we wanted something like that we were comfortable in.
Yeah. No.
SQL.
It's interesting because like a graph database, I've always found them deeply fascinating, but just never really been able to make it work in the real world compared to the established stuff. But it's like, everything's a graph problem if you look at it in the right angle. And surely we should be able to solve it this way. And then I can use these nice little pathfinding algorithms. And
It's all great, but... I was really interested to use it and was really happy that I got, you know, a couple months experience using it, even though we're not using it in production now. But Yeah, and we kept, you know, it's a whole sort of mind shift, because we kept saying, you know, I kept saying, oh yeah, so they're, you know, the rows and the table, and then you're like, oh wait, but they're not rows, right? In fact, it's not a table, you know, and you're like, what? Okay, the nodes, and then we kept having to, you know, change our how we describe this data, you know, the nodes in the, you know, in the graph, right? And it's just like a different conceptual way of thinking of data.
Right, but it's kind of interesting. We talk, you know, in software design manuals, they're always talking about matching the mental model of your users. In this case, right. Like you're the user, and
right,
like
right.
The database isn't matching your mental model, and so yeah, there's an incongruence. And yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah, and I think something. I mean, I think like we're still trying to find how to use graph databases, because some of our problems are really more suited to graph databases. Like we have something that we kind of call dependency chain, and that is a link of sort of cascading of, I guess, dependencies, right? So if you think about a power system, you know, power system has a dependency, say, you know, on water, maybe. So a water plant, let's just use this as an example. And your hospital is downstream, and that has a dependency on both the water plant and the power system. And so, you know, you've got these sort of cascading dependencies, and modeling that in a table could be pretty hairy, because, you know, you've got your, okay, dependency one, but many, you know, there's many, it's a lot of many-to-many relationships going on. And something like a graph, you know, can model that a lot better.
Yeah. As soon as you have one many-to-many, I start going, oh, right. God, here we go.
Yeah. 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 How many association tables you need, you know. And that's something we haven't really addressed, I don't think, yet. At least at my company. You know, there's technologies that have, but.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing about data science, right, is at least from, I was just looking when I was studying this. This is a couple of years ago. There was this Twitter feed, Big Data Borat, which had all these pithy sayings. And I mean, I remember being struck. I spent almost all my time cleaning the data, and then a teeny amount actually running an algorithm or something I made. And it's just kind of like, it felt very, you know, janitorial. But I think that's just kind of how it is, right?
It's toil.
Like, it's hard to clean it, and you have to do it the right way. And then, I guess you go down. Yeah. So it's.
Yep.
There's some quote about that.
But. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, in both roles, and I think, you know, we deal with a lot of sort of students, you know, who also deal with geospatial data. And there's, while there are certainly uniform, you know, there's GeoJSON, there's uniform ways of handling geospatial data and making sure that, you know, the data is the same from one government, you know, one organization to another, a lot of the format is not the same. And so we can build an entire data pipeline for, you know, our US data, right? So that's ingesting US census data, but we have the need now to ingest Japan census data, and it's entirely different. So that data pipeline, you know, we need to change drastically in order to get it to work with, you know, these files, basically.
Yeah.
And I always get the impression that data pipelines, you know, I'm more of a web jockey, but, you know, data pipelines are always like the sort of one-shot scripts that I write for myself to do stuff. And they're sort of bodged together with duct tape and, oh, you know, and I'll just run this here. And
the test passed, so it's good to go.
Yeah.
Right. But, right. I mean,
is that your
So the question is that accurate? Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, at least at both companies I've been in, we don't, you know, it almost seems like once the data's in, right, you do it once almost, you know, and then you don't have to do it again. We're not talking machine learning models or anything. We're just talking static data. And so, you know, you have all this, the duct tape, and you have, you know, it's all shoddily constructed, but then it's in, right? And you don't really, and every time you're doing that, you're in that process, you're going, oh gosh, we need a better way of doing this. But then it's in, you know, and you kind of forget about it. Right. And then, you know, then
well,
the
that's
next
everything.
Time, right.
Yeah. Well, you don't want to prematurely optimize it, right? I mean,
right,
don't
exactly.
Just polish your tooling. Got to use it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, right now we are developing, you know, well, knock on wood, but we're trying to develop a, you know, a more flexible, fully featured data pipeline that we can use when we deploy, say, you know, in Japan and China and India and, you know, where it can fit with, you know, I still don't know how this is going to work. Just being the one,
right?
Just being the one to you know, build the, to duct tape the pieces together. I can, yeah, I'm questioning how we'll find a solution, but exactly, that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, yeah. That's the programming challenge, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's, how often do these, does this change, right? Like, because some data sets you have to ingest, you know, minute by minute, if it's like power meter, and then some are, I don't know, you know, monthly, yearly.
Yep. I and census data is every 10 years, right? And so, you know, if you only have to do this, you know, hacky construction once every 10 years, right? You're like, that's not so bad. You know, we don't want to spend, yeah. But exactly, but something like pricing, like energy pricing data is like every, I don't know, every couple minutes, or meter data, like you're saying, is every couple minutes.
Well, yeah, because there's some, in the Boston area, there's a couple companies that are using Django to, Internet of Things to check on solar meters. And it's, as I recall, I mean, I remember being like, well, why don't the device manufacturers do this? But basically they need a degree of separation. So it's, I won't name names, but it's interesting. It's a very interesting problem. And it's kind of shocking that it isn't addressed by a big behemoth that I'm aware of, sort of smaller places that are doing this monitoring service for these power grids.
Yeah. Think it's, you know, we're still at the forefront of all the sort of smart grid and grid optimization work. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be exciting to see, see how it shapes up, because we have this old infrastructure, and then, you know, you're trying to glean insights and, you know, figure out basically, you know, how to optimize, you know, power on the grid.
Right. Well, and it's, I mean, Internet of Things is, I would think, Carlton, like a pretty good use case for, you know, async Django stuff. I mean, depending async anything, right? I mean, it's, aside from, you know, a chatbot or something, it's that's a real world application when I think of async up, because Django's adding async in 3.0. That's the first thing that comes to mind for me, all these Internet of Things. We have something just pounding off data, you know, every second or faster.
Yeah, so whenever you need anything to handle an event at an unknown interval, then async becomes perfect. So Internet of Things is perfect. You know, it doesn't know when you go and open your fridge door, but when it gets the fridge door open event, it needs to handle it and tell Amazon to send you some new milk. Or...
Interesting.
Right.
That's awesome.
I guess it's the unexpected part, because otherwise you could just plan for it, but it's the spikes that async really shines.
But like, come back to the energy optimization, because that's fascinating. I read a story a while back about Google, and obviously they control the environment in their data centers perfectly, but they use their AI to, you know, save 60% on the power bill or something. I don't know the number, but are we going to be able to do similar with the grid? You talked about the old infrastructure. Obviously, we can't just rip that up and start again. But do you think there are savings to be had and efficiency gains? And
yeah, definitely. And figuring out, there's certainly cost savings, there's energy savings, and not being, you know, a energy expert, I don't want to say too much, but there are certainly, we have very little information other than, you know, what your utility bill, right? The average consumer has very little information about what the demand is on their, you know, on the grid at a given time. You know, maybe they do want to, you know, lessen their energy bill in some ways, or, you know, put solar panels on their roofs. And, you know, if you wanted to change your energy provider, you know, basically areas have pretty much one energy provider and that's it, right? Like, we've got PG&E. PG&E, and we can't, you know, we can't change it. And, you know, I'm sure lots of people would like to. But I think giving consumers a little bit more insight into, you know, their sort of energy and electricity, whether that's through something like the Internet of Things and the smart grid, you know, that's going to be really revolutionizing the industry.
Right. Well, it's that two-parter of, you know, you could mail someone an automated monthly packet saying, here's your usage and how it's changed. But then you need that second part, like, here's a non-PG&E option.
Right.
Well, and in the solar context, you have an interesting thing where you have with people who are net, contributors to the grid, and actually it sort of messes things up for the utilities if, in a good way, like if there's too many people giving stuff, because electricity actually has to kind of flow like water, like in the same way that
like
LA create all the farmland because they're stealing too much. Anyways, is there anything we haven't covered that you want to address in the podcast? We're sort of coming up near the end. Or anything you want to plug?
Right. I don't think so. I mean, I would say, yeah, I've absolutely been very happy using GeoDjango. And for anybody who hasn't, play around with it. And they say that people who like maps really like maps. and GeoDjango certainly makes that, at least made me sort of love maps and geospatial data and doing queries and sort of making all of these data discoveries.
And you're moving back to Python world a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's about it. I did write some notes. I'm trying to see. Oh yeah. One thing that I just on the sort of the future of geospatial data, if I could say. So one thing I haven't handled much is, I've handled mainly 2D geometries, but handling 3D geometries, I think would be really interesting. So, my current company, we have, say we might map a flood, right? A flood has a depth. Being able to map this depth, we might glean other insights that we certainly might not from 2D data. So, volume of water.
Flood prediction as well, if you on this volume of water will this housing estate will be under threat and it needs this kind of barriers to protect it, that kind of thing.
Exactly. In fact, my current company, One Concern, does exactly that.
Right, okay.
So you have really just hit the nail on the head. Yeah.
Right, fine, super.
Yeah. So and I know PostGIS does have the ability to handle, I think, 3D data. But I haven't played around with that too much. But I would be very curious too.
Okay, but that's on the horizon. That's available to. So that's kind of cool.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I have to play around with this a little bit. I haven't used Django when I'm doing mapping. Well, I haven't done anywhere near the functionality we can. So I'm sort of excited to get in again.
Yeah.
So we will link to, you have a personal site. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you also for your talk last year. I thought that was a great introduction to GeoDjango.
Yeah, we'll link back to the talk, and I guess we should link to the docs too.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's funny that there's a specific tutorial because there's not that many tutorials within Django itself. People just think of the polls tutorial, but GeoDjango is really its own kind of world within Django.
Yeah. I think they use Spatial Light in the tutorial, and they use a shapefile. So I think they have you sort of seed your database using the shapefile and then create a simple model to play around with the data.
Yeah. Then you need a way to display it.
Yeah. I'm not remembering what mapping framework they use, but.
All right, Anna. Well, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about GeoDjango and the work you've been doing and the discussion around all of that has been super.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you for having me. This has been great. I wasn't sure if I'd be, taken a little break from GeoDjango, so I'm glad it went okay.
No, it's super.
No,
thank
I think that's the best. That's the best when you have a little perspective on it, right? Because when you're in the weeds, you don't really think about it in the same way as when you're a little bit far apart from it. So
right, totally.
All right. Thanks again.
All right.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys. Bye.